Marissa Handler is a writer and activist, and she's just returned from 3.5 months in Central America, where she visited Cuba, Oaxaca, Chiapas, and Guatemala. Marissa, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Miriam.
Okay, let's talk about Cuba. A lot of people in the peace and justice community look at Cuba as a relatively benign dictatorship. What did you find when you were there?
I went there with the same mindset. I think on the left we often lionize Cuba and make it seem like this wonderful alternative, and it's amazing really what the country has accomplished, being so close to the U.S., having maintained socialism despite U.S. embargoes. But what I found there was quite different from what I expected. There's a lot of frustration among Cubans, especially young Cubans, more than frustration, actual anger, fury. I was talking to a group of young Cubans who are street theater artists, and in fact, I was talking about how I felt about Bush in this country and how difficult it is not to hate him, and one of them said to me, "That's the way I feel about Castro," which was interesting to hear. So basically what I discovered was that Cuba really has many different shades of gray. You know, we paint it into black and white in this country on the left. We lionize it on the right, we demonize it, but it's really somewhere in the middle. I found a lot of ambivalence among Cubans, a sense of pride about what the country's accomplished being so close to the U.S., and also a sense of real frustration. There's a lot of poverty. It's an interesting place because there's not severe poverty. There's no children begging on the streets like you're going to see everywhere else in Latin America. But
well, and in the U.S.
Exactly. But the average standard of living is very low. So what you find there is an educated populace with often not much to do with their education.
And so is that the main source of the frustration? What about, like, freedom of speech? You were saying that this was a street theater group.
Right. I would say the main frustration that I, at least what I've come across, were threefold. One is certainly the poverty and the fact that the government salary is peanuts, really. And the second is absolutely about freedom of speech and the fact that there just is no space for dissidents among artists, among intellectuals. You can create and think what you want so long as it's not on any level in opposition to Castro. And the third major source of frustration is that Cubans aren't actually allowed to leave Cuba unless they're leaving, you know, working for the government or on a contract or invited by another country, you know, if they're an engineer or something like that, a doctor.
And this is because of restrictions from the government?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that would be a big deal. So we have this very well-educated population, which it sounds like they don't have enough jobs, and they can't leave.
Exactly, I had the same conversation with a couple of these young Cubans that I met, saying, as dictatorships go, this is a relatively benign one. And I mean, the response was, it's a psychological burden. One woman said, there's a lie that covers the island, and we are supposed to act like we believe it, although no one actually does.
And what is the big lie?
The big lie is that the system there is working, which most Cubans feel like it's not because of the poverty, and also just propaganda. You know, one thing for me that was very exciting as a global justice activist being there was that there was no commercialism. But the flip side is that there's a ton of propaganda. So as another young man said to me, according to the Cuban news, if you listen to the radio, there's nothing that happens outside of Cuba, nothing interesting, and everything that happens inside Cuba is good. So this is what they meant when they were saying there's a lie that covers the island. It's very difficult in a country where all the news is basically propaganda to determine what the truth is.
Do they have free access to the internet, and can they check news services outside of Cuba?
No, often they don't, actually. It is possible, but it's not easy, basically. So yes, there are certain things that are allowed. Email is allowed, etc., but accessing the general internet is not something that's easy for most Cubans to actually do. They can email, so they do have email accounts and can exchange communication, so it's not completely shut down. But getting onto general search engines and things like that is actually not possible for most computers. Again, it's an interesting situation because most people, you know, everybody has health care, everybody has a home. Compared to much of the world, you don't see the terrible extremes. So there's a lot there that is positive, but there's also a lot that's negative. And whether providing those for people by trading in things like freedom of speech and freedom of travel is worthwhile is a question that I really had to confront down there.
You said that the freedom of speech was very curtailed and that no dissidents were really allowed. Do you know what the mechanisms are? Is it just because the mass media is controlled by the government, or do you get the knock on the door in the middle of the night?
Both. There's actually a great book on this. It's called A Crack in the Wall. So for listeners that are interested in learning more about this, I highly recommend A Crack in the Wall. The mass media is controlled by the government, but also Fidel has cracked down very hard on dissent, and so journalists have been rounded up. There are a number of journalists that are in prison still in Cuba for having really spoken out about the government. It sort of infiltrates every area, and it's an interesting situation because it's not like he's going out and killing people, but he has imprisoned journalists, again, who have spoken out against. There are a lot of people who have left Cuba for political reasons as well as economic reasons.
Now, was it difficult for you to get into Cuba as an American?
It's not the easiest thing. Technically, because it's an economic embargo, the technical rule is that you're not actually allowed to spend money in Cuba. So there's no rule against being in Cuba. There's just a rule, there's just a law against spending money in Cuba. So what that means is that basically for anybody who's interested in going to Cuba, you're not actually allowed to spend money there. So don't leave any evidence that you've been there.
So it takes a little bit of planning to do a trip there.
It does take a lot of planning. And given that, you know, there are thousands of Americans that have visited Cuba over the past few years. And Cubans, you know, are not surprised to hear that, or at least they weren't surprised to hear that I was American. And many Cubans said, oh, I have a cousin in Miami. I have a brother in Miami. You know, everybody had family here.
Yeah, so there's a lot more exchange going on between the two countries than either government would probably like to admit.
Absolutely, there is.
The other place you visited, you went to Chiapas for the International Zapatista Gathering.
I did, yes.
First, can you give our listeners some background on the Zapatistas?
Absolutely. The Zapatistas are famous for, you know, often among people in the global justice movement, they're sort of seen as the guiding light to the movement. They came out of the jungle of Chiapas, and this is Mayan people, indigenous people, that were oppressed for centuries, oppressed and exploited for rubber, for timber.
Now, where is Chiapas?
Chiapas is in southern Mexico. It's the southern easternmost Mexican state. It's also the poorest state in Mexico. It's a big state. It is a geographically beautiful state and a very resource-rich state as well. And it's also heavily indigenous. And the Zapatistas came out of the jungles of Chiapas and into San Cristobal, which is the main city in Oaxaca, or rather, sorry, excuse me, the main city in Chiapas, and came out with a resistance that has inspired people all over the world. You know, they called for autonomy from the state of Mexico, saying, you know, the state has never given us anything, so we would like to govern ourselves. And the way that they have structured this revolution has been very unique. Some of their guiding principles are things like asking, we walk, caminando preguntamos, or preguntando caminamos, which means that we don't have all the answers. We ask questions as we go, and we come up with the answers as we go. And another one is leading, we obey. In other words, the people that are leading us, their job is actually to obey the will of the people. It is an intensely democratic grassroots experiment.
Originally, this was an armed struggle.
Yes.
And they did win some measure of autonomy?
Yes. And it is still armed. You know, Subcomandante Marcos, who's the sort of the face and the voice of this movement, has said that we have an army so that one day we may not have, you know, we will not have armies. Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, which is the EZLN, is their army. And in fact, throughout the encuentro, the gathering, there were soldiers. They did not have guns. They had batons. But basically, the Zapatistas were and continue to be under threat from, at this point, very much from paramilitaries in the area, and still from the state, although to a lesser extent than they were when they first emerged from the jungle.
Okay, so now this gathering that you attended, in the email that you sent me, you said it consisted of a roving band of over 2,000 people from all over the world. What sorts of issues were they addressing, and what sorts of solutions were presented?
Yeah, this was really a fascinating trip. I mean, a lot of Europeans, a lot of Mexicans, a few Americans, and essentially it was an opportunity for the Zapatistas to present to the rest of the world or to people who were interested and who came how they were running their civil societies. So the Zapatistas have been critiqued by people over the, I would say, the past 3 to 5 years for not being nearly as visible as they were initially. The reason, however, is that they've really been focusing intensely on building their civil society, which I see as a very, very good and necessary thing. I think, obviously, it's important to be there and to be connecting with allies around the world, but it's also really important to build within. And so they actually conducted presentations, and we went to three different caracoles, three different areas, where they conducted presentations on things like education and healthcare and women's rights and autonomy, describing steps they were taking within each of these communities to advance on these issues.
So are they collecting taxes from the people there to support their schools and that sort of thing?
They get a lot of support from people all over the world who are the supported foundations and groups in support of them. So as far as I can gather, most of their financial support is coming from that. They're not taking anything from the government, and the people are very poor. But as they've said repeatedly and still maintain, we're grateful for the support that you give us, the support that the rest of the world offers us, but we would do it either way. We would do it alone. You know, these are people who have been very poor for centuries, millennia, really. And so they don't actually need a whole lot in the way of financial resources. They're taking the resources that they are getting, however, and using them in very creative ways, building clinics, building schools, and also initiating efforts like this where they are providing opportunities for people all over the world to come together and to learn. And one thing that was spearheaded by the Zapatistas, which just took place, was an international indigenous convention in Guerrero in Mexico. So they actually invited indigenous people from all over the world, and it was the first event of its kind, and I wasn't able to go, but reports that I've heard from there, it sounds like it was a really exciting time for indigenous people to speak about the struggles that they share.
So it sounds like this is a revolution that is really working.
It really is. It really is. And I know you're interested in talking about Oaxaca as well, and one thing that's interesting, because I went between these two places, was seeing how differently they're operating. In Chiapas, one of the things that makes it sort of a unique experiment is that they're not engaging with the state at all. Most revolutions throughout history have been people directly confronting or engaging with the state or asking something from the state. And in Chiapas, they're saying, we actually want nothing to do with you, nothing to do with the state. We want autonomy, and we want local community governance.
And the government in Mexico City has basically been going along with this.
That's a difficult question to answer. On a superficial level, you could say yes, but I think it's far more complicated than that. I think the real answer would probably be no. I think that paramilitaries are definitely getting support, and this is not necessarily federal government support. However, there's the state government of Chiapas is. sees the Zapatistas as, well, shall we say, as a major thorn in their side. So they're very invested in kind of wrecking this experiment.
So there's a state government that is hooked up with the federal government there. And that state government probably has its own services, like clinics and schools and that sort of thing. Is that?
Yes, they do. And so the Zapatista communities are actually spread out in a number of different places in Chiapas, among communities that are not Zapatista, that are not autonomous. So it's an interesting thing, actually, even just driving through the area, because as one man said to me, you can tell which communities are Zapatista and which are not because the Zapatistas don't drink. There's actually a rule. I believe this was based on the incidence of domestic violence and how and its relationship with alcohol abuse. But there's actually a rule that in Zapatista communities there's no drinking. And he said, and you'll notice we're going through a town, there's men sitting drinking beer, that this is not a Zapatista community.
They've actually got prohibition going.
They do. They do. And, you know, when we were down there for the Encuentro, there were definitely some internationals who were craving beers at certain points. But there were wonderful celebrations every night, and it was kind of a beautiful thing to see all of these people running around and dancing and singing and not a drop of alcohol.
So what's your sense from talking to the people who are living in the Zapatistas communities? Are they feeling like this is working for them?
Oh, absolutely. There's a tremendous sense of pride and commitment. That is crystal clear everywhere we went. It's incredible, actually, how committed they are and just what courage really it is, because they're up against a pretty hefty state apparatus and have been since the very beginning. The Zapatistas still are being subjected to attacks by paramilitary groups. This is an ongoing threat. I would definitely not say that they feel safe.
Okay, so now let's move over to Oaxaca. There's been wide-scale protests there. Can you give us an idea of who's protesting and why?
The protests are actually a very broad range of groups coming under the umbrella of a coalition called APO, the Asamblea Popular de los Pueblos de Oaxaca. And what that means is a popular assembly of the people of Oaxaca. And it's comprised of teachers' unions, labor unions, student groups, rural communities. It's pretty huge, actually. And everything began last June with teachers striking for more resources, essentially, to be going to education, to be going to schools and to teachers.
From what the reports that I read, it sounded kind of like the teachers had a strike every year.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing and an entrenched issue, and essentially the roots are in entrenched poverty and injustice, and that's something that has certainly not just appeared on the scene. That's been there probably for about as long as the modern state of Mexico has. But last year is when things blew up and started getting global headlines. And in June of last year, 70,000 teachers struck in the city of Oaxaca. And these are people representing communities all over the state of Oaxaca, not just within the city of Oaxaca. Is the capital city of the state, which is also named Oaxaca.
Okay. Oh, and just to give listeners an idea, now, where is this in Mexico?
It's basically a central state, actually.
About how far is it from Chiapas?
It's adjoining Chiapas.
Okay.
Also a southern state, but Mexico, if you look at it, it's I'm trying to think of a good metaphor for it.
Well,
it sort of stretches.
Yeah, I think just so that we get an idea, it's the southern part. It borders on Chiapas. So you were saying earlier that there was a contrast between the way that things were done in Chiapas and in Oaxaca.
The main contrast is that in Oaxaca, they're engaging directly with the state and asking for things from the state government, which they're not getting enough of. The staging ground for the protests has been urban, although, again, it's representing peoples from all over the state of Oaxaca, which are many rural communities. But mostly the actual protests have been within the city of Oaxaca. It is not just indigenous peoples or campesinos, but rather people from all different walks of life, again, teachers, nurses, students.
And they're not looking for autonomy. They're just looking for more services, more money from the government.
They're basically looking for justice, more resources going towards schools, more fair distribution of wealth economically, removing corruption from government. Mexico is infamous for corruption in its governments, and the state of Oaxaca is no exception. The governor of Oaxaca, a man named Ulises Ruiz Ortiz, and his nickname is Uro, has cracked down very, very harshly on the protests.
You were in the middle of one of these crackdowns, weren't you?
I was. I got stuck in the middle of one, and I was actually taking notes. I was writing about it as a journalist. and ended up being on the front lines during the Gelaguetza Popular. So just to explain to your listeners that the Gelaguetza is an annual celebration of indigenous cultures of dance and music, and there are communities all over from Oaxaca that are represented in this. But it's become a huge commercial event that's actually prohibitively expensive. So the people that attend it are usually tourists, not actually Oaxacans. So APO, the coalition, used this as an opportunity to build a Gelaguetza Popular, or a people's Gelaguetza, which would be free and an opportunity for all kinds of Oaxacans to actually to celebrate their own culture. The governor said, you cannot hold this in the place where the Gelaguetza is typically held, and they put a bunch of police lines blocking the entrance. There were about 10,000 people that marched up the hill to the Cerro del Fortín, which is where it's usually held, and then we came in contact with the police lines, and I was with a couple of friends, also U.S. activists, and we were at the front of those lines, and well, the police started throwing tear gas, and things got quite chaotic very quickly.
We heard about that here in the U.S., and then it seemed like all of the news about what was going on in Oaxaca just kind of stopped. What's going on there now? Are there ongoing protests? Did everybody just kind of pack it up and go home?
It's somewhere in the middle of that. No, there are not. There hasn't been something as major as the Gelaguetza Popular that's been planned, but no one has packed up and gone home. This is certainly not the last we've heard from Oaxaca, and the governor has taken superficial steps towards engaging in dialogue, although he's not really giving an inch here. And APO and the teachers and the people of Oaxaca are not going to stop calling for justice. I would say it's sort of on a low boil at this point. The city even feels tense. It's palpable when you're there. People are very unhappy.
Now, when you say that they're looking for justice, what kind of justice are they looking for?
They're looking for economic justice, so resources that are actually going back to the people instead of into the same hands of the richest elite, the small elite at the top of the Mexican hierarchy. And they're also looking for a government that's actually representative of the people, where when people protest or ask to be heard, the governor is willing to sit down and talk to them.
And right now, they don't have the ear of the governor.
By his actions, from what I'd say any objective observer has gathered so far, he's not sincerely interested in dialogue and engaging in dialogue with the people. And I think that until he takes steps in that direction where he's actually showing that he's interested in trying to meet their needs, there will be continuing protests.
So when you say that they're looking for economic justice because a very few number of people have a lot of wealth, are they looking for, like, heavier taxes? Are they looking for land redistribution? I'm trying to get an idea of, you know, what exactly does that entail?
I think, you know, different people have called for different policies, but I think land redistribution is not necessarily it's not quite that radical. It's more just that a significant percentage of the state budget actually go towards schools. So there are teachers that are teaching in rural areas that have no schools, basically. They don't actually have schoolhouses. And there are no books. You know, I spoke with a teacher in Oaxaca who was tabling in the Central Plaza, you know, telling me we don't even have books. We don't even have the resources. You know, these children often can't even come to school because they're working all day. Basically, what they would like to see is some money diverted into education, basically. And you know, and other people are calling for health care. I think also actually just a fair response. With thousands arrested over the course of last year, there are hundreds who have disappeared. And what this means is that we don't know what's happened to them. The police have picked them up, and they haven't come back. There have been at least 23 that have been killed over the past year, although
those are the only ones that where they found the bodies.
Right. So it's numbers probably higher than that.
It's a matter of real heavy-handed tactics here, too.
Yes. Mm. In Spanish, the term for this is mano dura, and what that means literally is a tough hand, you know, or a heavy hand, and that's definitely the response that this governor has taken, and all that has been created is a buildup of more and more frustration among Oaxacans.
I've been speaking with Marissa Handler, writer and activist, who is just coming back from 3.5 months in Central America. Now, you had a book out, I believe it was last year, Loyal to the Sky. Do you have another book in the works?
I've been working on journalism, so I was also in Guatemala, and I have a story coming out in the San Francisco Chronicle in the next couple of weeks about the state of human rights there, which is abysmal. And I've actually been moving in the direction of fiction, so I've been doing some work focusing on, working on a novella that's actually set in, I'm South African originally, as I write in Loyal to the Sky. I grew up in South Africa, and we immigrated to the States in 1988. And the novella that I'm working on is actually set in South Africa after we left in 1992, which is right when the transition was happening between apartheid and a democratic government. And to me, it was a tremendously exciting time, and it's a time that has a lot to teach us. For those of us who are working for justice in this country, and often I think it feels like we're up against this vast beast, and can we make any change?
And I think we're out of time. Once again, I've been talking to Marissa Handler. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for being interested in this.